Welcome to the political scene. I'm Susan Glasser.
Over multiple months, Donald Trump oversaw and coordinated a sophisticated seven-part plan to overturn the presidential election and prevent the transfer of presidential power.
Last night, we got a long-awaited first look at what the House Select Committee has learned about the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. It was a gripping, focused, and we must say highly choreographed presentation in primetime, with more than a few startling revelations about the final days of the Trump administration, and especially about its catastrophic, violent ending, unprecedented in American history. I'm joined now by two of my excellent Washington colleagues, my good friends Jane Mayer and Evan Osnos, who were also watching last night. Hi, Jane. Hi, Evan. So glad to be with you.
Hi, Susan.
Great to be here.
All right. Finally, the Washington Bureau gets its chance to hash it all out. I have to say there's a lot to hash out. We've been waiting a year and a half for this investigation. Jane, the investigative reporter in me, says, you know, let's start out with what did we learn? And also with this question of, was it new fundamentally? Was this an exercise in revelation or in narration? What did you think?
I think narration, there was a promise of bombshells, and I don't know if there were bombshells, but there were many small explosions along the way in terms of details. But for me, the big takeaway was that this was a really strong case, almost a case for the prosecution, pulling all the details together and pointing in one direction, which was at former President Donald Trump. And it connected dots in a way that I don't think has been done exactly before.
Yeah, Evan, Jamie Raskin, one of the members of the committee who, of course, led Donald Trump's impeachment on this very subject in the immediate aftermath of January 6th, he made a pretty inflated claim a couple weeks ago that this was going to literally blow the roof off the House, as in the House of Representatives. Did day one accomplish that?
Well, it depends what you really think is the long-term impact. Look, there was not some single moment with some revelatory piece of tape in which all of a sudden Donald Trump comes forward and says, I did it all and it was all me. But what there was, and I think all of us who are in this business of writing and of thinking about stories, there was this very clear effort to say that when you put all the pieces together in a disciplined, clear, lucid way, that it can have a different kind of impact than when it drips out over the course of a year in one story after another. And that really, that was the ultimate goal, was, you know, what we say when as Jane mentioned, to connect the dots, is actually about punching through that crust, that way in which Americans have just kind of built this into our lives, and to say, no, this is something that needs a new name. This was something that has never happened in American history. It has never happened, and it must never happen again. And that was an attempted coup to seize control of the United States government. And I think in that respect, it was successful.
Yeah, attempted coup is literally the phrase that Benny Thompson, the chairman of the committee, the Mississippi Democrat, used in his opening remarks, framing the conversation. Jane, I want to get back to this notion, because I think you're right. It sounded very much, especially Liz Cheney's presentation, it sounded like a prosecutor. It sounded like an indictment. It sounded like one of the intended audiences last night was not just breaking through to the public, as Evan pointed out, but literally speaking directly to the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, and essentially saying, okay, here we are, guy. We've assembled this evidence. Go ahead and do your thing. Do you think they were aiming to show what a prosecution and an indictment of Donald Trump would look like?
It felt that way. And I have to say, one of the big questions I came away with afterwards is, are they going to make a referral at the end of this set of hearings and maybe in their report? Are they going to make a referral to the Justice Department that it prosecute the former President Donald Trump? I don't know, but it felt like they are teeing up the case for sure. And one of the elements that I think they were working on It's a difficulty if you were to try to prosecute Trump is his mindset. And what they need to prove is, you know, what the legal term is, mens rea. They need to show that he had a guilty mindset, that this wasn't just that he was sort of believed that he'd been cheated and that this was sort of done in good faith. I think what they were painting was a picture of a would-be tyrant acting in bad faith. The way they did that was by showing one by one his top aides telling him that he'd lost, that there was no there, as one of the lawyers had put it, that Bill Barr, the former attorney general, told him it's bullshit. And he was told, he was warned, he knew, he heard from the people who were the experts, you lost, but he did this anyway. And that would be a key element in any kind of case against him.
So let's talk about the plot a little bit. I was interested that both Cheney and Thompson framed it, Evan, as we have this 7-part conspiracy, essentially, that we're going to unpack for you over the course of these hearings throughout the month of June. And, you know, the different elements include being told and lying to the public about the election. They include attacking state election officials and undermining the count in states. They include a plot to oust his own acting attorney general in order to try to get the Justice Department to be a part of the plot. And that is going to be the subject of a whole hearing next week. It's one of the most amazing. We can have a whole separate conversation on that. But Evan, let's talk about the details. Jane's right. It was really powerful to hear Donald Trump condemned in a way by Donald Trump's own advisors and family members. The witnesses for the prosecution here are all the president's men and women.
Yeah, it's really quite a striking contrast, actually, to here we are on the anniversary of Watergate, that the most powerful piece of evidence you can put forward today in 2022 is not the high-toned rhetoric of an elected member of Congress. It's not as if the most effective technique would have been to have some revered senator get up and say something stentorian and that would have persuaded the American public. That period is not the period we live in. What people need is primary documents, in effect. They needed those videos. They needed to see the words come out of Ivanka Trump's mouth saying, I agreed with Bill Barr. I agreed that there was nothing to this case. And that in its own way is somewhat it's a dispiriting measure of the time that we're living in, that there is no longer the kind of credibility of our political class that they can make the case that a fellow member of the party has disgraced the office of the presidency and that would be sufficient. I mean, Liz Cheney did as much as you can to kind of provide the rhetorical context. But in the end, the real ammunition here were the words of the people within the palace itself. And I think that's the key thing that, as Jane said, what you're beginning to see is the assemblage of a case that the people around Trump and, in effect, the Trump administration, dear listener, was lying to you no matter how devoted you are to him. And I think that's quite a subtle and sophisticated thing, because what we know is that in this day and age, one of the things that people hate is the idea that there are people in Washington who say one thing behind closed doors and another thing in public. And they've turned that technique on the Trump administration itself to show that inside the palace they were saying one thing, and to the public, and at great risk to that public, they were saying something else.
I wonder, Jane, you've written a lot about these kind of characters, Mike Pence, your profile of Mike Pence during the administration, and was a memorable one of perhaps the most obsequious and slavish Trump official. And yet in the end, of course, it was Pence's defiance of Trump that did shut down the attempted coup on January 6th. What do you make of these enablers who become the witnesses against him?
I mean, first of all, I think the particular portrait and the actions of Mike Pence, I think are really, I mean, I think it's an incredible story. because there was no one more slavishly devoted and who wouldn't say a word of criticism about Trump all the way through this, the, you know, one terrible moment after the next, and he continued to stand there as described in The New Yorker with the sort of gaze of Nancy Reagan looking at her husband. I mean, he was standing there with a, you know, doe-eyed and in adoration of Trump through all these years. And to hear, I mean, of course, this was happening behind the scenes, so we didn't have all the details till after all of this. But it turns out he had at least some bits of backbone here, and held his ground and stood up for the Constitution and wouldn't do the wrong thing, and I mean that's like an amazing story, I think, and also it adds, I don't know, to me, I guess I had discounted to some extent the gravity of the threats to Mike Pence, you know, the hang Mike Pence. I thought it was just sort of a rhetorical thing. More and more, I think I'm becoming convinced that Trump really wished Mike Pence harm, and that he really wanted to neutralize him.
Well, Jane, one of the big revelations last night, in fact, was exactly that. This is new evidence that Liz Cheney presented, in which she quoted witnesses as saying that Trump, to his staff, basically agreed with the people who were demanding to hang Mike Pence, and even said maybe our supporters have the right idea. Imagine the president of the United States saying that about the vice president.
That is, you want to know, I don't know what's a bombshell to me. That is unbelievably shocking.
Yeah. I have to tell you, that is the thing that I am really struck by today, is that video that we all watched, that 11 extraordinary minutes of video, which was extremely carefully done. They were pointing out that when Donald Trump tweeted that Mike Pence didn't have the courage and so on and so on, that somebody stood up with a bullhorn and read that out on the steps of the Capitol, and then you began to hear these chants of hang Mike Pence. Then you see the camera cut to this noose hanging off the gallows. All of that really is a sort of coming attractions, frankly, for what you're going to hear over the course of these next hearings, is all of that explained in more detail, how each of those decisions by the president and the people around him led to this attempted coup.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, POD15, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Speaking of coming attractions, Jane, one of the revelations from last night that I'm certainly eager to hear more about was the news that a number of Republican members of Congress, according to the committee, including Scott Perry, the congressman from Pennsylvania, who was the one who backstage was setting Donald Trump up with the Justice Department official who he hoped to install as his new attorney general in order to bring the Justice Department in on his plot. Even Scott Perry and a number of these Republican members apparently asked Donald Trump in the final days to give them presidential pardons, which does seem like it's as close to an admission that they did something wrong in participating in this rigged election plotting. So what do you make of that revelation, and what more do you think we could learn about it?
I think we need some names. Which ones asked? And, you know, I mean, we have heard from his own lips that Jared Kushner was working on pardons. I would think he might have a list of who was asking for them. So we know who to ask. Mm-hmm. And we need some details. I would like to just point out one tiny, this is a minor thing, but Scott Perry, who we know asked for a pardon and who seems to be in the thick of this. When he first came to my attention, he was getting praised by Janie Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, at a kind of a celebration that she was hosting. And so, you know, it gets you back, this just saying, it's a little sideline, but he seemed to have been a favorite of the a Supreme Court Justice's wife. And here he is asking for a pardon for his role in a coup. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. I mean, there was another moment that sort of along the lines of how things that we're learning now change what we're experiencing in politics. Number one is the scene of people in Kevin McCarthy's office fleeing, running for their lives. And then at the time, we now know, based on tapes that have come out, that Kevin McCarthy said, this cannot be swept under the rug. We have to think about the 25th Amendment. He talked about the full range of possible repercussions. And here we are today, and he was the one getting up and doing the sort of pre-buttal to the hearing and saying this is all a political stunt. And those kinds of pieces of incontrovertible documentary evidence are very hard to explain away.
Well, Evan, I'm so glad you pointed out that scene, which was one of the more memorable scenes in the video, especially for those paying attention at home who understand the backstage political drama in the House Republican Conference, where Kevin McCarthy's falling out. They purged Liz Cheney, right? So she is up there delivering this indictment of Donald Trump and of her own party. One of the more memorable lines was the conclusion of her presentation last night, where she speaks directly to Kevin McCarthy and to the Republicans who have purged her, who have chosen Donald Trump over the truth, who have chosen Donald Trump over her, right? And she speaks to them in a very different tone at the end of her presentation, which is very prosecutorial, very matter of fact. And she says, Donald Trump sooner or later will be gone, but your dishonor will live forever. I mean, that is just like, I mean, that's just Shakespearean stuff there.
Yeah. She is speaking to history in a sense. And I had an interesting moment along those lines of thinking how this actually is going to look to us all in 20 or 30 years. We were texting a bunch of friends over the course of this hearing, and one of them pointed out that his 15-year-old son was kind of looking on at some of this video. And this was the first time that this 15-year-old had seen images of people saying, hang Mike Pence. And he said, my God. And what's fascinating about that is all of us who live in this world and talk about it and write about it, all of us know about that. We've been talking about it for a year. But we have to remind ourselves that for certain big portions of the American public and the future, that's a kid who's going to be voting in 3 years. And this is about a process of getting on the record in a clear, digestible, concise way the horror of what happened on that day and what led to it.
And I just want to say, I think that that's a value in its own right. I know there's a ton of sort of debate within the sort of pundit world of, you know, is this a flop? Is this a dud? You know, it'll never break through, all of that. And those are, they are real questions about how you reach this whole country at this point. But there's value in just documenting what happened. And I think that, you know, that was the committee's job. And so far, they've done a pretty good job of it, you know. And I mean, it had its lag moments. I would say the weakest moment maybe was Nick Quested, the British documentarian, speaking sort of very logistically about what the Proud Boys were doing minute by minute. It was an effort to try to show that they really didn't come to hear Donald Trump. They came with one thing in mind, which was the insurrection at the Capitol. But a British documentarian is maybe not the best first witness. But I think that Caroline Edwards, the Capitol Hill policewoman, more than made up for it.
Evan, you consistently in this conversation, I think, have correctly raised the questions around who is the audience for this January 6th committee hearings? What is the potential political impact. What does it mean for the Democratic Party and for the Republican Party that you have one party so clearly still identified with a man that the committee is characterizing as an attempted coup plotter?
Well, I think we all know that Fox News was the one network that did not carry these hearings last night. If you dipped into Fox News for a while, you would have seen that they had on a parade of Trump defenders and denialists of various kinds who disputed the legitimacy of this. And so the painful fact is that for a large portion of Americans, what happened last night was operating in a parallel universe from the one they inhabit. And that's not something that's going to break through in one night. It's not going to penetrate. But, you know, I am sometimes reminded these days of a humbling fact about politics, that things change faster than we sometimes assume. And that is not a Pollyanna-ish view. If you take, for example, the issue of gay marriage, where you say to yourself, at a certain point in the not-so-distant past, it was an impossibility, completely impossible that you might have real change at the political level. And then you had a certain generation of people growing up coming to say, well, this is actually a part of our lives. This is normal, and the prior situation is unacceptable. And then things can change. And I think on some level, what we're seeing right now, which is the building of this historical case, this thing that will linger and be available to the future voters of not just 10 years from now, but 2 years from now, is part of getting people prepared for the idea that what we're living through now and what Fox News is trafficking in will eventually become a stain on American political history. And even if there are large numbers of people who don't buy into that now, they will come to buy into that. And I sort of cling to that only because the reality is that we are so obviously dug in, so completely entrenched, that an event even as carefully composed as the one we're watching is not going to persuade the people who are beyond persuasion right now.
Jane, you've written a lot about Fox, a memorable portrait of, you know, the Trump era network that helped to bring us Trump. Is this a different network now? I mean, have they even abandoned sort of their old pretense of covering news? They banished their anchors to a different channel entirely last night in order to simply show Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity.
When I did the piece a couple years ago, the people who'd been at Fox during the Roger Ailes era, which was the original architect of Fox, really, said it's gotten worse and worse in terms of becoming not news but propaganda. I thought it was interesting, though, that Newsmax aired these hearings, and it made me wonder, because I think one takeaway, or at least a question I have after this, is it's possible that these hearings will, to some extent, damage Trump himself and help DeSantis and help Mike Pence and, alienate some Republicans from Trump and push them towards a different candidate. And I wondered if Newsmax, which is based in Florida, might not be sort of a pro-DeSantis group. So maybe you'll see some of that dynamic.
Do you see a world, Jane, where Mike Pence has any constituency, do you think?
You know, when I traveled with him for the piece I did for The New Yorker, I have to say I was struck that he lacks charisma. I don't know. He doesn't have the dynamism of that Trump had. And I would watch him giving speeches, and a few minutes into it, the audience around me would start talking to each other and lose interest in him. And so I didn't see him as, a gigantic talent on the scene. But, he's obviously getting a lot of airtime here that makes him look heroic.
So, Evan, you brought us, I think, correctly around to the question of history and, what in the long run is going to be the framing that American history places around the Trump presidency and especially this catastrophic, violent ending to it, the first time in American history that an American president has refused to accept the peaceful transfer of power and his own defeat. So I want to ask all of us in that spirit, there's a long tradition of these big public events, these hearings, Watergate, Iran-Contra. Republicans tried to stage their own version of it with the sort of failed but endless Benghazi hearings. So I want to ask both of you, as we finish up this conversation today, is there anything memorable? Is there one line or one moment that you think will end up in history from last night?
Well, I think in the spirit of history, it's worth reminding ourselves that they started the evening putting up the words of Abraham Lincoln, who was committing himself and his administration to giving up power, basically saying that democracy depends, in the end, most fundamentally, on the consent of the loser. You have to be willing to lose. And that is the whole organizing idea for everything we're seeing, which is to say that Donald Trump's completely sui generis presidency, that the fact that he is the only president in 2.5 centuries not to accept that basic concept of democracy, is what they need Americans to come away from. Because whether or not this leads to criminal prosecution is one thing. Whether or not it affects the midterms is another thing. But the larger, more durable need is to persuade Americans that this is something that must never happen again. It simply cannot happen again.
Jane, a takeaway for history? What did Trump know and when did he know it?
Well, that certainly is the major one of the major takeaways. I was just trying to think if there were phrases that came out of this, and one that stuck in my mind was Caroline Edwards saying this was a war, and I think it sort of hung in the air like a promise of something awful if we don't do something about this. She comes to and she's slipping in blood, and the other officers are throwing up, and she looks around. She said, "I couldn't believe it. It was like a movie. This was a war," and you know, is this the first battle of a war in this country, or are we going to try to have the rule of law, restored? And so that stuck with me.
Well, you two are both, I have to say, very high-minded. I was thinking that one of you was going to answer Bill Barr and bullshit. Come on. But thank you both so much for joining me in this conversation today. And thank all of our listeners, of course, to the political scene. Jane Mayer is The New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent. Evan Osnos is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene, and I'm Susan Glasser. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Next week, my colleague Tyler Fugit, a senior editor at The New Yorker, will be rotating in as a guest host of the program. Thank you so much for listening.